Good morning. You are listening to another edition of Tell It Like It Is, WGXC Community Radio. And today, my name is Christina Malisoff, in case you don't know. And today, my guest has come down from Albany, John Amidon, Chapter President for Veterans for Peace. He is the founder and co-facilitator of the Kateri Peace Conference. The Kateri Tekakwitha Peace Conference is in its fourth annual round. It's going to take place this coming August 17th through August 18th. And we'll tell you more about that coming up shortly. Stay tuned. So, okay, thank you for joining us again for Tell It Like It Is. Tell It Like It is on every Thursday from 10 a.m. to 11. My name is Christina Malisoff, and my guest in the studio today is John Amidon. John, thank you so much for coming down to Hudson.
Oh, it's great to be here.
And John, you are the chapter president for what, the Greater Capital Region of Veterans for Peace?
Or? Chapter 10 in the Capital District, and we also have a chapter up in Saratoga, New York.
Okay, well, we've had John Adams on this show a few times before, so that he is the president, I think the acting president now of Veterans for Peace?
He was the former president of National, VFP National.
Okay, great.
And Elliot's still out there, very active, and doing peace trainings all the time.
So, John, just to start right off, I wanted to ask you, first of all, how did the conference start, and can you tell us a little bit about what the purpose of the conference is?
Sure. Way back when, this is the 14th annual conference, and way back when, I think it was 98, I started the conference. We were working on closing the School of the Americas, and the School of the Americas is an institution at Fort Benning, Georgia, where we bring up Latin American soldiers and train them, and they had a record, an infamous record of going home and killing union organizers, killing social workers, educators, Jesuit priests, nuns, religious people, anybody who really helped the poor. The graduates of the school often went home and killed, and they were involved in many, many military coups in Latin America. So Roy Bourgeois, Father Roy Bourgeois, became involved as his friends, his personal friends, church people were killed, and he took it up as a cause, and it's been going on it since 1990. And it's just a despicable school run by the U.S. Army. It needs to be closed. We actually won a vote in Congress once, but it was negotiated out, the closure. The school actually did close for a month, but that was subterfuge to change the name and say they revamped it.
And
they haven't.
What is the name now?
It's called WINSEC, a Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. It needs to be closed.
And we actually had Nancy Smith on the show before. She's a local resident in Columbia County, and Nancy actually was arrested. We had her on talking about why she crossed the line to be arrested. Nancy spent 6 months in prison. As a result of that, and so that does that have some of what bearing on what you're doing with this conference?
Because yes,
your conference is called "A Call Crossing the Line: A Call to Revolutionary Love."
Yeah, I'd like to explain that title. I've been arrested a number of times in civil resistance actions, and one of the more recent ones out in California, Vandenberg Air Force Base, was opposing the launch of the Minuteman III missile. We test launched the missile three times a year. The Air Force states it costs $21 million a launch. We believe it actually costs more like $28 million a launch. But even taking the Air Force figures, there's $63 million on a test launching of an illegal weapon system. which is first strike and clearly endangers the entire world. So I was arrested there. And when you cross the line, what you'll maybe, you know, I mean, everybody has different experiences and every arrest is very different. And some are very civil and relaxed and others are really quite edgy. At Vandenberg, it was a bit more on the edgy side. I had to calm down the person who was holding me after he had me handcuffed with my hands behind my back and a hand on my shoulder and a hand on the cuffs.
When you say the person, do you mean the police?
I was an Air Force.
Or military police.
Military police. And he seemed quite agitated, so I had to calm him down, you know, to say relax. You know, I mean, A, I was handcuffed, and B, I wasn't resisting, and C, I was cooperating. Because we're nonviolent resistance, but he was I don't know if he was angry or fearful or both, but in any case, I felt really strong that particular evening, and with just such a splendid group of people, including Daniel Ellsberg, Cindy Schuin, Father Louis Vitali, and other people from Code Pink, who are just tremendous organization, particularly brave women, and. So I was calm, being held, calmed my the person who was handling me down. And out of that experience, I sort of gained insight into love. And the funny thing is, I wasn't expecting this. And the way it kind of worked was, I realized in my consciousness I had a fear file, like you have files on your computer. Anyway, I had this fear file in my own consciousness, and to cross the line to risk arrest and jail time, you need to overcome some fear. And all of us, we have a lot of different fears. You know, what will people think of me? What will I think of myself? Will I lose my job if you're working, you know, et cetera. I mean, the fears are endless, but you have to overcome them to cross the line and risk arrest. So when I crossed that line, I clicked off a fear file. Much like on your computer, when you delete a file, you create a space for something else to go in it. Well, the thing about human consciousness, potentially, and at least I think it's true for all of us, is that we are naturally connected to love. And when I clicked off my fear file in my own consciousness, one I really didn't know I had. I mean, I knew I was fearful, but I didn't know I could click it off. Well, anyway, love, the natural connection to love, was there, and I found myself understanding in an increased capacity love, a revolutionary kind of love which allows people to really take an active stand and be involved in their own lives, to insist on fair treatment of each other, to insist that our resources be used in ways that affirm life, that create a dynamic for a very positive living, you know, where people get health care, where they get the education and housing they need, where we act out of respect for each other and do not live in isolation anymore. And fear keeps you isolated, keeps you silent, keeps you complicit in ways that you don't want to be.
Well, I dare say that fear is the basis for all violence, because when you're in a state of fear, that's when you're protecting yourself and you'll do it at all costs.
I agree. Anyway, so we created this tile. I work with a dear friend, Maureen Amund, who is really quite brilliant. And we were talking about all of this experience, and she understood the concept of love and added to it, in very nuanced ways. So what we ended up with is crossing the line, a call to revolutionary love. And this conference is about love. It's the kind of love that invites you to move beyond fear and move beyond isolation. And then you can go out and take stands in the world about the things that you are passionate about. And it may be anti-war. It may be solar power. It may be just getting a high school in your community that isn't a dropout factory. It can be any number of things. So that's what the conference, we hope, is going to be more fully realizing for all of the people who attend.
So, John, I just want to take a second. This a call to revolutionary love is also reminds me of a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King, but I wanted to play this quick clip from Martin Luther King on love and power. So if you just take a second to listen to that, share that with you.
What happened is that some of our philosophers got off base. And one of the great problems of history is that the concepts of love and power have usually been contrasted as opposites, polar opposites. So that love is identified with a resignation of power and power with a denial of love. It was this misinterpretation that caused the philosopher Nietzsche, who was the philosopher of the will to power, to reject the Christian concept of love. It was the same misinterpretation which induced Christian theologians to reject Nietzsche's philosophy of the will to power in the name of the Christian idea of love. Now, we got to get this thing right. What is needed is a realization that power without love is reckless and abusive, and that love without power is sentimental and anemic. Power at its best. Power at its best is love, implementing the demands of justice, and justice at its best is love correcting everything that stands against love.
So that was a clip from Martin Luther King. I just wanted to ask you also, John, this is the 14th annual conference that you've organized. What keeps you going? What
keeps me going really is the day itself. It's such a splendid day. People come, they relax, they start talking to each other. It's a space of thoughtful ideas, community, and sharing. Just a great day of conversation and getting to know your neighbor, focused on issues of peace and justice. That was such a splendid quote from Dr. King. He's so eloquent always and so thoughtful. And I wanted to mention that on Friday evening we have James Ricks reading the Declaration of Independence from Vietnam, a very famous speech by Dr. Martin Luther King. And it's also known as Beyond Vietnam or A Time to Break Silence. Mm-hmm. It has three different titles. It is such a powerful speech, and then our panel will comment. Our panel being David Swanson, John from War is a Crime, John Horgan, a scientist, a former writer for Scientific American who wrote a book called The End of War. And Kathy Kelly is coming, and she will be part of our panel. Claire Grady of the St. Patrick's Four, Matt Sutherland, and... I guess that's the entirety of the panel. All great activists and people working so hard for peace with justice.
John, I wanted to ask you, who does attend the conference? What kind of people do you have? Do you have the same folks, or do you reach out to new folks? And what kind of outcomes do you have expectations for outcomes from this? Like a spin-off of people ready, energized to organize, and how does that play out?
Yeah, we never quite know who's coming. Mostly people do not register in advance. It's always helpful to know in advance. We do have a website. I just wanted to mention very quickly, KateriPeaceConference.org, all small case.
Can you spell that, please?
Yes, it's K-A-T-E-R-I, Kateri, Peace, P-E-A-C-E, Conference, C-O-N-F-E-R-E-N-C-E.org. It's all small case and all run together. And you can find complete information about the conference at that website. My number is 518-312-6442. Again, that's 518-312-6442. If you don't have computer access, just give me a holler. I'll be glad to fill you in. We never turn people away for lack of money either. I mean, we do charge money, modest amounts, because we have bills to pay and transportation costs, and you get lunches included. But if you don't have any money and you can find your way there, we certainly won't turn you away. We want you to come. So in terms of numbers, the very first year I did it, I had 7 people. I think the high point was about 250 people came up to the shrine. Many years we have around 100. Last year we were down a little bit. We had about 45 people, maybe 50.
And what do you see as the effects? What is the spinoff? What outcomes come out of this conference?
People have a great day. They learn quite a bit about a series of issues that we're discussing that particular year. Some people are really inspired to get more involved in their communities and work on things that are particularly important. In New York State, for example, now hydrofracking has become a big issue because the gas companies have proven themselves to be in Pennsylvania to be thoroughly irresponsible and pump in carcinogenic chemicals into the aquifer and basically poison the water. This is something we clearly don't want. I was at a anti-fracking rally in Utica yesterday, and thank you, all you folks from Utica. Upstate New York anti-drone coalition. We now have drones flying in New York, over New York, and they're piloted at Hancock Airfield. And we have people opposing drone warfare because it is illegitimate, illegal, and very murderous. It is computerized robotic killing of women and children in Pakistan, Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen. And tomorrow night, just as an aside, Ed Canaan will be at the Bethlehem, not tomorrow night, excuse me, tonight, a little confused. He'll be at the Bethlehem Library tonight at 7 p.m. in Delmar, New York. Ed is from Syracuse, a longtime activist from the Upstate Anti-Drone Coalition, talking about why we're opposed to drones and what we're doing about it. So if you happen to be up that way, 7 p.m., Bethlehem Library tonight. But in any case, many good things come out of it. People are inspired. The day is inspiring. That's what's kept us going for 14 years, because this truly is a labor of love. We don't make money doing it. And it is hard work, because so many people here seem so uninvolved, so mesmerized by American Idol or Dancing with the Stars or you know, the bread and circuses that the empire provides to keep you distracted from becoming more active in taking command of your own life, taking sovereignty. You can change the society. We can change the society. It doesn't have to be what it is.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit more about that. John Horgan, I found very interesting as one of the speakers of the conference. At the conference, I was curious. I was curious about what he has to say about the possibility of really changing human nature, or is it nurture? This it seems insistence and during our whole history towards violence. Is this really part of human consciousness? Is this something that we can change? Is it something that we can regulate? What is the basis of these ongoing wars? And what is his take on this? And what will he be speaking about?
I think the best thing to do a little bit later on in the program, but not too much later, is we just give John Horgan a call.
Okay.
And ask him directly, because we have his phone number and he is available as... You know, hopefully that will hold when we call him.
Well, we'll probably take a break shortly then and do that. Who else do we have that we may get online?
We're hopeful that David Swanson will be able to call in. But we have his cell phone number, and he may be on a plane, however, so a sure thing. And Kathy Kelly would love to call in, but she is in Afghanistan, and it really has to do with satellite links, mm-hmm. and what happens to, I mean, I'm not quite sure. I think Afghanistan must be about 9 hour differential in time.
Something
like that, depending on where she is. So it's pretty much reverse time. So it's not clear if she'll be able to call in, but we're hoping. But anyway, we will take a break and hook up with John Horgan.
Absolutely. So stay tuned for that. Before we take a break, though, I wanted to ask this conference is happening at the National Kateri Tekakwitha Shrine in Fonda, New York. And I wanted to ask you why there, and who was Kateri?
Okay. It's an interesting history. Like I said, I first started working on closing the School of the Americas I started in the mid-90s and thought it would be good to walk a pilgrimage and to close the School of the Americas and erase consciousness. So I looked at where I was in Albany, and I said, well, the shrine is a place that has the intersection of Catholics and Indians, because in Central America, in Guatemala in particular, there was a genocide against the Mayan Indians, or an attempted genocide to take their lands. And also many of the victims in Latin America were Catholic. So I thought this would be a place to start. So I went to the shrine, and it was a place to start in an odd sort of way. Father Kevin Kenny was a priest who had lived in Guatemala in the mid-80s, so he absolutely understood what I was talking about, how U.S. foreign policy and the intervention and the money and the arms we sent created this thoroughly bloody nightmare for these countries like Guatemala and El Salvador and Nicaragua. You know, and recently there was a coup in Honduras, and it goes on and on. And so that's how I ended up at the shrine, thinking that Catholics and Indians would be interested. And they weren't, you know, in all honesty, for the most part, they really weren't. And that's a long discussion, which I'll try to do very briefly, but essentially, you know, and this is some hard learning, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it. Many of the Indian cultures have the warrior ethos, so they tended to support the concept of the warrior and to some degree war. The what is termed traditional Indians, which isn't entirely correct, but in any case, the non-Christian Indians were very unhappy with the church, particularly the black robes in that area, because it destroyed their culture. So they weren't particularly supportive. The Christian Indians were very much in line with war, like most Christian churches, unfortunately. And Catholics as a whole, you know, in all honesty, I wish they had a more peaceful church, one that's supported the military far less than it does, and the militarization of our society. And that's kind of stating it as it is, and maybe understating it. I mean, I really wish our churches and our church leaders taught peace, taught nonviolence, looked at the example of Jesus and said he didn't raise an army, he didn't have a violent revolution. He taught love your enemies. What does your church say? Does it say love your enemies? I mean, it's a hard task. But anyway, I learned that while there were certainly exceptional individuals in the church who are truly great peace workers, the Bergens, Father Louis Vitale, Jerry Sawada, Steve Kelly, you know, and many others who I'm not mentioning here, Claire Grady, the Grady family, Catholic workers. We need more people supporting peace, particularly in Christianity.
Well, you know, that brings up the question to me the support for peace, or the feeling that you need to change the world or change yourself to support peace, is a very individual one-to-one, I think, occurrence. And to try to institutionalize it through any kind of church or religion takes away that individual seeing, that personalized vision, that each person has to kind of see the need for that. You can't tell someone that. They have to see that truth for themselves. So I want to segue into just a quick question to you before we take our break. You were a U.S. Marine Corps vet, correct?
Yes.
And what was the insight that you had to change from where you were to where you are now?
Okay. First of all, I'd like to tell you why I went into Marine Corps. And like so many people in our country who join the service, they're going into the service to escape domestic abuse. Mm. They're being beaten at home, either by their spouses or their parents. To put it bluntly, a lot of women join the military to get away from their violent husbands. You know, there seems to be, there is reason to believe there's a war on women in this country. And boy, that does that war increase in the military, because once you're in, 30% of the women are sexually abused and or raped who are in the military. So it doesn't really improve things. I went to escape domestic abuse myself, joined at 17, to get away, you know, and that was an avenue to get away. Mm. So that's how I got in the Marine Corps. When I got in the Marine Corps, you know, for example, this was 1965, Lee Harvey Oswald was held up as an example of what a well-motivated Marine with a rifle could do. And for those of you who are younger, Lee Harvey Oswald assassinated John F. Kennedy. He certainly was involved with it. There's all this theory about other shooters too. But in any case, what I learned about the Marine Corps very quickly, my platoon was investigated for brutality. There was a cover-up. To ensure that cover-up, the drill instructors threatened to kill all of us, any one of us who would testify against them. So I knew right away the Marine Corps was a lie. Mm. And, you know, as David Swanson has in his book, title, War is a Lie. Mm-hmm. It's a lie. You know, when you start killing each other to solve your problems, it's a lie. There's nothing noble about it. It's bloody. It's violent. It's sickening. It is the worst form of human behavior, killing each other.
Okay. And this is such a deep issue. It's so connected to everything. It is the only issue. So bear with us. We have an hour. We have about a half hour left. We're going to go to a quick break, and then stay tuned. We will try to get John Horgan on the line. And can you tell us again who John Horgan is?
John Horgan is a scientist, a journalist. He's written a new book called The End of War. He's written for Scientific American and many other notable publications. And
Is he an ecobiologist, or do you know what kind of...
I'm not sure if he has that qualification, okay. But well, we can talk to him.
Okay, great. All right, stay tuned. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Christina Malasoff, and we are back with another with Tell It Like It Is, the second half of our program. Hopefully, we will be joined right now with science writer John Horgan. Let's see if John, are you there?
Again, if you need help, hang up and then dial your
operator. Okay, so obviously we do not have John on board. So maybe this would be a good time while I try to get him. If you can tell us a little bit about that. And we're speaking, I'm sorry, to John Amidon. He is the chapter president for Veterans for Peace, and he is the founder and co-facilitator of the Kateri Peace Conference. It's the 14th annual peace conference. And John, can you tell us, before you go into that, just tell us again about how people can find out more about the conference and when the dates are. Thanks.
Sure. The conference is titled Crossing the Line, A Call to Revolutionary Love. It's Friday, August 17th. And the conference, it starts at 6 p.m. On Saturday, August 18th, it starts at 9 a.m. It's at the Kateri Tekakwitha Shrine, the National Kateri Shrine in Fonda, New York. That's exit 28 on the thruway. It's about an hour north of Albany. We have a website, Kateri Peace Conference, all one word, .org, and that's spelled Kateri. PEACECONFERENCE.org, Kateri Peace Conference.org. That will provide you with nuanced information. Something I haven't mentioned yet is that before the conference, we're having a mini retreat, a day of reflection titled Active Love and Nonviolence, the Only Moral Response to War, with Bishop Thomas Gumbleton. And this starts at 9 a.m. on Friday, August 17th. And I don't know if you know of Bishop Gumbleton. I hope you do. He's writes a column for the National Catholic Reporter. When Michael Moore sought a voice, you know, within the faith community to articulate the essential inhumanity of capitalism, and this was in his movie Capitalism, A Love Story, it was Bishop Gumbleton to he turned to, and Bishop Gumbleton has a lifetime commitment to peace and justice. He's won many, many honors. He's a generous man, and his humility and warmth is truly life-affirming. His parishioners have called him a pastor in the truest sense, and he really is. I love this guy, and we are so pleased that Bishop Gumbleton is returning to lead us in a day of reflection. And this will be, he's speaking from his own base, Christian Catholic base, but it is, we are an interfaith peace conference, and everybody is welcome to attend the day of reflection or the peace conference itself. I mean, both of them are good. It's all interfaith. If you are non-theistic, you're welcome to. Peace and justice is for everyone in the world, okay. All of us.
Thank you, John. Hopefully we have John Horgan on the line.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, great. Okay, John, we've got you this time. Just to introduce you, John, you are a science writer, and you've written for the New York Times.
Yeah, I have a column for Scientific American. I write for lots of people.
Okay, and you also wrote a book, which is, I'm sorry.
The End of War.
Thank you. and you will be speaking at the conference. I believe you are the first speaker at the conference. And
the message that that I've tried to convey in The End of War and in a lot of my journalism over the last few years is that war is a choice. It is not like a force of nature. It's not the inevitable product of our genes or of competition for resources and the human tendency to over-reproduce. There's a very widespread sense among lots of people that war is a permanent part of the human condition. And think that this is something that science has revealed to us. And so I wrote The End of War to rebut this point of view, mm-hmm. to point out that actually science shows that war emerged quite recently in human prehistory and that many societies, from tribal societies to the most advanced modern industrial societies, have been able to come together and collectively renounce war and militarism. And I think that humanity as a whole can do that. I think actually it can happen quite quickly if we have a strong grassroots movement plus inspired, bold leadership. I really think the time is right now for a global, successful anti-war movement.
Well, this is a tremendous thing that you're saying, and I actually am in the group of people who have thought maybe in a negative way the inevitability of war. Again, over resources, there seems to be instances in history where there's long-term peace until societies are stressed by the need to get resources or the lack of resources. And Derek Jensen, who is an environmental activist on the West Coast, talks quite often about the environmental pressures on societies, and he, so I'm just, can you talk a little bit about that?
There is tremendous pessimism, and this really distresses me, in the progressive left, and especially among green activists, people like Bill McKibben, for example, about the possibility that global warming will lead to shortages of water and food, and that inevitably will lead to terrible conflicts. What people need to know is that scholarly analyses, both of tribal people and of war among states over the past years in particular, don't provide any evidence for this idea that the scarcity of resources leads inevitably to violent conflict.
Mm-hmm.
If we are pessimistic and if we think that resource scarcity will lead to violence, then that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy because we prepare for war and we may even launch preemptive strikes. But there are plenty of cases where people peacefully resolve disputes over, for example, water. I mean, you've got a really striking example is Israel and Jordan over the past 50 or 60 years have had water sharing agreements that have carried right through periods of terrible violence. So have Pakistan and India. In fact, the greatest cause of war, and again, this emerges, and I lay it out in my book, The End of War. This emerges from scientific studies of warfare. The greatest cause of war is war itself. Once societies become militarized and have a tradition of war and even elevate war into this kind of grand, glorious undertaking, war becomes quite likely. War also perpetuates itself through the desire for vengeance. And if you fear that your neighbor is going to attack you, you're more likely to go to war. So war is this kind of parasite. It's like a, you know, there's this term meme that refers to cultural innovations that then spread like viruses. Mm-hmm. War is a meme that infects society, but we can get rid of it if we have the will to do so.
Well, if you're saying then that it's much more of a cultural force as opposed to an inherent human condition, how do we change that? It seems sometimes in my own experience that to change people or to ask them to start thinking differently is very difficult. People are very connected to how they grew up, what their parents think, what political party they associate with.
Absolutely.
I mean, how do you change that? That's such a box. That's such a concrete, you know, around an individual.
It's already changing. You know, if you go back just 100 years, you can find very prominent intellectuals, including and leaders. Teddy Roosevelt is a good example. Even William James, who talked about war as this ultimate extreme sport that was really good for the character of a nation and particularly good for the character of young men. You know, it turned them in to go out and wage war. World War One and World War Two really undermined that view of war. So you just do not get intellectuals and leaders talking about war in this really kind of positive way. War is now presented as a kind of necessary evil. You need to use violence to prevent or to suppress some other greater violence. So there's already been some evolution in our cultural attitudes toward war. I think it's been brought about in part by the media exposing the horrors of war as never before, and the terrible wastefulness of war. And we actually, believe it or not, are living in a period when war has become rather rare, and casualties from war are very low compared to historical levels, particularly in the last century, and particularly in the first half of the last century. So there are a lot of talking about classic international war as possibly fading from view. So I think we just need to on some of these trends that are already happening, and again, to insist on our leaders, particularly here in the United States, which is still an extremely militaristic society. We need to insist on our leaders helping envision a world without war and helping us get to this world without imperiling our security. And I really am confident. I feel that a smart, eloquent leader can seize this opportunity and build a really effective anti-war coalition.
John, do you, with that said, and with this conference coming up, and you talking about this issue, do you see this leadership coming? Where do you see this leadership coming from? Do you see it coming from people like yourself, from young folks? I mean, it also seems sometimes that we rely so much on a leader. We thought Obama was one of those leaders.
You're right. And he's turned out to be pretty disappointed, I've got to say. I was a real Obama believer, and he's been so hawkish. You know, he got us out of Iraq, but we're still waging what I think is an unjust war in Afghanistan, and he's carrying out drone assassinations and commando strikes all over the world in secret right now, which is appalling to me. I think we need the United States to show some moral leadership, and I do think that this needs to happen at all levels. It needs to happen at the grassroots level. I would like to see the peace movement reach out to conservatives, especially to religious conservatives, mm-hmm. and to make them, I don't know, try to lay a guilt trip on them about how they can support hawkish policies when their own sacred scriptures prohibit killing. I think there's also enormous potential in reaching out to fiscal conservatives like Tea Party types and pointing out to them, and some of them have already realized this, that the U.S. defense spending is enormously wasteful. It is a horrendous use of taxpayer dollars when there's so many other things that we need that money for, education and infrastructure and healthcare and all these sorts of things. So I think with the right rhetoric, and again with, you know, pressure from voters, from a very broad coalition of people, I think some of these changes can come about quite quickly.
Well, John Horgan, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And again, your book is At the End of War, and the
yes.
publisher is?
It's McSweeney's Press.
Great. John, thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing you at the conference.
Same here. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. So, John Amidon, we are going to go to a quick musical break, and then we will get David Swanson on the line. Can you tell us who David Swanson is? He's another speaker at the conference.
Yeah, David is another writer, correspondent, author. He runs the website space War is a Lie, formerly After Downing Street. He's written a book called War is a Lie, and actually, his website is War is a Crime. I misspoke there. And He's just a terrific speaker and activist, and has been working against war. And his book, which he will, if we can get him, we're hopeful.
Okay.
If we're not, we'll talk a little bit about his book and the different chapters, such as wars are not fought against evil, wars are not launched in defense, etc.
Well, we're going to try to get him on the line right now. We'll go to a quick musical break. You're listening to Tell It Like It Is every Thursday from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC. I'm joined today by John Amadon in studio. He is the chapter president of Veterans for Peace, and we are talking about the Kateri Peace Conference, which is going to be happening August 17th and 18th in Fonda, New York. Hold on, and we'll be right back.
Sare jon tiramakan kido kalodi tiramakan na kalajula jebate Tonya tiramakan susare jon tiramakan Chido kalodi tiramakanna susare jon tiramakan Tiramakan, susare jong tiramakan, doña tiramakan.
Okay, this is Christina Malisoff. We're back with Tell It Like It Is, joined by John Amadon, and hopefully we will be joined by David Swanson on the air. Can you hear us, David?
Yes, hi, good to be here.
Great, thank you for joining us on WGXC Community Radio. And John, could you introduce us to David, please?
Sure. David is an author, a talk show host, Talk Nation Radio. He runs War is a Crime website, and he's written a book that we want to hear about right now called War is a Lie, and he's worked as a news correspondent also. And so, David, why don't you jump right in here and tell us about your book and what you're going to be talking about at the conference. And
oh, well, I don't know what I'm going to be talking about at the conference, since that's in the distant future, but I do have a number of books out. One is called War is a Lie, which I sort of wrote in response to the Iraq War and this misunderstanding that there was something unique about it and that we were lied into it, and sort of looks at the history of warfare by our nation and every other nation, and finds a common theme of the types of lies that are used to promote every single war we've ever seen. And I have a more recent book called When the World Outlawed War, which looks back to the late 1920s when our government sort of led the nations of the world in putting a treaty on the books that banned the use of war, which then were called the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which was then used at the end of World War II to prosecute this brand new crime of making war. And this was all sort of hypocritical colonial. The poor nations were left out, but the rich nations haven't gone to war with each other again since. They just go to war on the poor countries. And then I have a book out by myself and many others, experts in a variety of fields, called The Military-Industrial Complex at 50, that looks at the past 51 years now since Eisenhower warned us about this madness.
That's a train you're hearing in the background. There's nothing we can do about that, but the studios here in Hudson are located right next to a train depot. It's ironic that this morning on Democracy Now, that the U.S. has basically torpedoed the U.N. arms trade treaty, which would have been... Hold on one moment. Which would have been a major step forward, again, towards regulating, as you said, what we did in the 20s, regulating war.
I don't know, because even through the 20s, even at the moment of legally outlawing war, nations were arming themselves more than ever before and preparing for the Second World War. And in fact, the treaty banning war was not in and of itself sufficient to prevent World War II, but you're absolutely right that the United States is on the wrong side of that. And if the United States claims to not want Russia arming Syria, it ought to do something to make it illegal. But of course, the United States is arming every other nation of that region and many other nations around the globe. We're far and away the number one exporter of weapons. Many of our wars are fought, at least in part, against U.S.-made weapons. It's a huge business in this country. And it looks like we're going more or less into a war in Syria, with Reuters reporting yesterday that Obama has secretly authorized support to the rebels in Syria. I wasn't asked about that. I don't think anybody listening was.
Right. So another undeclared, we're entering another undeclared war.
I have some personal experience there, because I actually was on a delegation and I have met with President Assad of Syria, and it's a very nuanced situation in Syria. And clearly, I don't, you know, having had experience traveled in the country, I clearly don't know what's going on in that country. And I say that because if you're only listening to Western media here and getting your news from here, you clearly don't know what's going on in Syria also. What we receive is very incomplete and biased news in this country. David, I was particularly impressed by a lot of the chapters in your book, Warriors Are Not Heroes. Being a Marine, I agree with that. Definitely, we weren't heroes. Wars are not won, and they're not ended by enlarging them. They're just splendid titles. And if you'd like to amplify in any of these thoughts, wars are not waged out of generosity. Wars are not launched in defense. Also very true. Would you care to comment on those?
Yeah, a friend of mine suggested I should have reversed the titles and made them claims or myths. You know, wars are launched in defense. Wars are waged out of generosity and so forth. But either way you put it, these are the themes, the lies that crop up time and again. And some of them are taking more significance, are being used to win over more of the population than others now. And it's possible to see it as a sign of progress of a sort, that the claim that wars are generous and philanthropic and humanitarian, whether the nations we're bombing want it or not, that has to play a bigger role, as opposed to, you know, the open racism or the claims of colonial benevolence. You know, maybe it's a sign of progress, but that we fall for it, that we continue to fall for the idea of humanitarian war is just staggeringly embarrassing. I can't imagine how much longer people are going to be able to believe that the next one is going to be the one. But of course, no one understands the extent of the devastation in Iraq caused by our country. No one understands the hell that Libya is today. You know, after these acts of liberation, they vanish from the U.S. corporate news media, and we believe that, well, whether that nation is perfect yet or not, it's on the track because we liberated it. And so somehow we have to get the information out that we have yet to build a nation. We have yet to launch a war that did anyone any good. I'm going next week to the Veterans for Peace Convention down in Florida, and we're going to be talking about Latin America. And there you've got over a dozen cases of U.S. intervention to look at, and not a single one of them made people better off. So this idea that Syria is going to be the one, you know, Syria, where we're supporting al-Qaeda and child soldiers and racists and assassins and torturers, is going to be the one.
where war makes people better off and peace and stability result, it's just insanity.
We only have 30 seconds, if that. In the last 30 seconds, can you tell us what message you would give folks who are in agreement that war, for whatever guise it's waged under, is awful, the consequences are horrible. But what would you tell them? Is this an inevitability for human beings to launch wars? Is this part of our nature, or is this something that can be changed?
Well, of course not. And read John and listen to John Horgan speak with me together at the conference coming up in New York State. War is a sporadic appearance through human culture. Many countries have done without it, have ended it, have brought it back, have limited it, and it's not in our biology, and there's no excuse for pretending it's inevitable and allowing it to continue.
Thank you so much, David Swanson, and we look forward to hearing you talk at the conference. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
So, August 17th, Friday, August 18th, at the National Kateri Shrine Fonda, New York, is our conference, Crossing the Line, I Call the Revolutionary Love. Earlier on Friday, Act of Love and Nonviolence, the Only Moral Response to War, A Day of Reflection with Bishop Thomas Gumbleton. Nobody will be turned away for lack of money, so come if you are interested.
And
thank you.
The website, www.kateri, Peace Conference, all one word, kateripeaceconference.org for more information. I want to thank so much John Amadon for coming down from Albany today, chapter president for Veterans for Peace. He's the founder and co-facilitator of this 14th annual Kateri Tekakwitha Peace Conference. I want to end very quickly with a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It says, "When I speak of love, I am not speaking of some sentimental and weak response. Love is somehow the key that unlocks the door which leads to ultimate reality. Let us hope that this spirit will become the order of the day." And with that said, this is another edition of Tell It Like It Is. Please stay tuned. Coming up right now will be Al Jazeera English. And you are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra, New York.